Hello and welcome to the new edition of ICTJ Dispatches, in which we speak to ICTJ's experts returning from missions in countries grappling with legacies of human rights abuse and looking to institute some of the measures of accountability and acknowledgement. This edition is with Eduardo Gonzalez, the director of ICTJ's Truth and Memory program, who just came back from a mission to Sri Lanka. Welcome, Eduardo.
Thank you, Rafik.
Sri Lanka, as we know, is trying to deal with the aftermath of the abuses of the civil war between the government and Tamil Tigers, especially the culmination of it, where in the final operations of the government forces in the Jaffna Peninsula, there have been allegations of vast civilian casualties and multiple crimes. Before we go into the questions of what is to be done, Eduardo, can you tell us first what was your mission to Sri Lanka?
Yeah, perhaps calling it a mission is an overstatement. It was an invitation from a local organization called the International Center for Ethnic Studies, which is a well-established think tank in Sri Lanka dedicated to the study of issues of peacemaking and the understanding of ethnic and religious differences and nationalism. What they were doing was to conduct a series of dialogues in the country to discuss about what most people see as an important opportunity to look into past violations committed during the conflict. This opportunity, of course, is given by the changing political environment since the victory of new president Maithripala Sirisena in January of this year. So my role was to serve as a resource person and share the insights of a comparative view of transitional justice processes and to help inform a dialogue with other experiences. I was there also with Justice Albi Sachs from South Africa, who was presenting the experiences of South Africa and another approach to justice processes.
Talking about the political change that you referred to, for our listeners who are not necessarily aware, immediately after the operations which have ended civil war, in which the crimes that we talked about happened, the former government of Rajapaksa basically denied any implication that there have been crimes committed. It was very forceful in this denial. It hailed what was a flawless security operation. In that, it had support of some of very powerful states internationally. And now, on the other hand, there has been a UN inquiry which has established that the story was somewhat different. There have been many testimonies, books written about the abuses by UN former staff and so on. But this denial was very entrenched. Now, with the somewhat surprising victory of Mr. Sirisena, now we are hearing a different kind of voice from Sri Lanka, from the government, about the readiness to actually acknowledge what happened. What has this political change brought about in terms of different approach to dealing with these abuses?
Yes, as you say, the events of 2009, the ending of the war and the military defeat of the LTTE, brought very significant scrutiny over the actions of the Sri Lankan government, and at the same, a very entrenched position by the government to deny the allegations. which resulted not just in denial, but also in lack of cooperation with UN inquiries looking into these allegations. Plus, in the terrain in which I feel perhaps a bit more knowledgeable, which is truth-seeking, the government launched an initiative that they call the Truth Commission, called the Lessons Learned and Reconciliation Commission, which is an initiative that has been very criticized internationally and nationally in Sri Lanka as an effort to actually not inquire but deny the allegations of what happened. Indeed, there are inquiries that were that were conducted by the UN. There is one by the Human Rights Council that is going to be released in September of this year. Now, what is interesting is that a new political situation emerged. And this has to do with a number of factors. President Rajapaksa assumed that his prestige as the victor of this conflict against the Tamil separatists would provide him with the credibility and the political capital to be re-elected and to actually have a very long process of political hegemony to the point where perhaps he would be re-elected indefinitely. And to do that, he counted on the support of what he expected would be a very united vote of the Sinhalese Buddhist population, the majority of the country. What happened, though, is that he was defeated by a very wide coalition, including the vote of the North and the East zones, which are Tamil or Muslim or Christian, and a very significant vote in the Sinhala zones, by people who were very critical of authoritarian tendencies that they perceived in the Rajapaksa government, and by very serious accusations of corruption and nepotism. In fact, the allegations of corruption maybe were more important in some areas for some voters than the allegations of human rights violations. It's perfectly possible, and that is what I heard in the terrain. Now, this victory by Sirisena and the challengers resulted in a complete change of political discourse by the government, accepting by different actors, the president, the foreign minister, the prime minister, that there should be what they call a credible mechanism to look into the past and to seek accountability. It is perhaps a little bit unclear exactly what that mechanism is, but the government has been engaging with the international community to look into this. And that is perhaps another detail that addresses your question. The former government cultivated a very studied action of denial and rejection of international watchdogs. So they denied access to the country to researchers from international organizations, for example. And they alleged that human rights investigations were some kind of a Western or neo-imperialistic plot against the sovereignty of the country. And that resulted in the government affirming relations with other geopolitical players like China. So what the government now is doing is looking into the past, but is also repositioning or modulating the international positions of Sri Lanka to a position that is probably more similar to what the country has had in the past, very linked to Commonwealth countries, for example, and trying to seek cooperation with the international community. So that is the international factor, definitely is a significant one here.
From what we could hear in public statements by President Sirisena and others, there were references to some sort of South Africa-like model of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Do you think this is the direction in which they are going? And do you, in fact, think that this is the right model for Sri Lanka?
Yeah, I would probably say no and no. First, it's actually the past government that was emphasizing very significantly the idea of so-called South African model. And they encouraged the study of the South African model in Sri Lanka. What has happened, I think, is perhaps precisely because of the emphasis by the past government on that model, the new government is having a more critical re-examination of the idea. And also communities in the north and the east where violations took place have also been able to talk more now about what they think very honestly. And so I think that Sri Lanka is no longer in a position in which it announces a single model to follow, and certainly particularly the South African one, which the past government understood also in a very simplified manner as some kind of a very easy truth for justice exchange or trade. Now, second, I am not sure that that is the model that the Sri Lankans want to follow. In fact, I don't even think that South African colleagues who live through the South African model would say that that is the only route to follow. I was able to share this week of work in the country with Justice Sachs, who clearly said that South Africa was an important element in the conversation about justice, but he would not say that that was the model that Sri Lanka had to follow. And my impression was that for some of the groups of people we talked with, in fact, there was a very strong need for accountability and a very pointed discussion about whether an amnesty for war crimes or crimes against humanity is acceptable or permissible. And so I think that that probably no, probably the idea of reviving archaeologically a truth commission that was created 20 years ago before there was an international criminal court, before the Inter-American system passed significant jurisprudence against amnesties, before the UN Secretary General instructed his representatives in the terrain not to accept amnesties for war crimes, I don't think that that would be possible. There are elements, of course, that need to be examined. I think that it was very clear that the South African model was a model that put a lot of value on publicity of the processes. I see that as a very important opportunity for Sri Lanka, for any country that would look into examining the past.
It is also very interesting that General Fonseca, who has actually led the operations at the end of the civil war that defeated the Tamil Tigers, has himself said that he would welcome some sort of war crimes inquiry or investigation, which indicates that accountability is certainly on the table in these discussions. You mentioned that in one of your responses, UN Human Rights Council has conducted an inquiry led by former Finnish Prime Minister Martti Ahtisaari. The report was supposed to have been released in February, but the delay was made until September to allow for some sort of response by the government in terms of its intention to seriously look into this. Now, what do you think this report will, how do you think it will impact the dynamics in Sri Lanka? Do you think that it will in a way speed up the possible presentation of this new mechanism, and once it is released, what the relationship would be with any truth-seeking effort?
Well, first of all, it's true, the report was ready to be released in February or March of this year, if I'm not wrong, and the release has been postponed. I think the postponement of the presentation of the report is a prudent measure, by the Human Rights Council, recognizing that there is a new situation in the terrain, and that it's important to give the new government, which is just taking over, an opportunity to look into these issues and to find adequate responses to it. Also, I think that for the government, it is important to have some sort of respite in the first few months after their inauguration to consolidate the political scenario. We must remember that Sri Lanka had in January only presidential elections. The parliament continues to have the same composition it had during the previous administration. So it is only in September, by the way, when the new parliamentary elections are going to be held. And so the question is, what is going to be also the result of those parliamentary elections? For the government, it's very important to ensure that they represent the new political configuration. And conducting those elections under the current political debate is probably what they want to do. It would be important to see then, when the report is released, what do the new political leaders of Sri Lanka think, not just in the executive branch, but also in parliament. Now, the executive branch is talking about a credible mechanism. It looks, in fact, that they are looking into mechanisms in plural. They are talking on the one side of the possibility of a court, which would have elements of domestic jurisdiction and authority, and some probably levels of cooperation with international experts. On the other side, most leaders are talking about the idea of a truth commission, which is a positive sign because that probably means that they are not considering that the exercise of the lessons learned and reconciliation commission was actually complete. And on that respect, they are also talking of some form of cooperation between Sri Lankans and international experts. And finally, they have established a high-level office called the Office of National Unity, led by a very high-level figure, former President Kumaratunga. President Kumaratunga is in charge of this new institution, which is focusing on victim-oriented activities. They are looking into institutional reforms that are needed to prevent the repetition of the crimes. They are looking into elements of healing and attention to victims. And on top of that, the government has been taking some very important steps. For example, they have restituted land in the north that had been appropriated by the army during the military operations. They have been supporting the return to those lands by people who were forcibly displaced. The foreign minister very recently, in fact the week I was there, was leading an initiative to actually issue national documentation of identity to Sri Lankans who live in the diaspora for a long time, and in part also related to conflict. So they are taking a number of actions in very different fronts. I think perhaps that is what it means to have a credible mechanism, because in my view, it has to be credible not just to the international community, but mostly to the national scenario, and particularly to the victims.
Well, thank you, Eduardo. I think that we can rightly say that there is new hope in Sri Lanka after a prolonged period of not only violations, but also denial and attempts to whitewash what happened. Now we have heard about the possibility of a new approach. We will certainly continue to follow closely the situation in Sri Lanka, and thank you for these insights to all our listeners. Until the next time, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Thank you so much.